Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, welcome to another book club. This week we are joined by Francesca. I can't believe I've messed up the Francesca again. That's what I did last time. I'm so worried about the Stavrakopoulou that I can do easily that I can't say Francesca. Francesca Stavrakopoulou, her fantastic book, God and Anatomy. Hello, Francesca. Professor Francesca.
Hello, Professor. It's nice to see you again.
Lovely to see you. You've been on Rahulastapur, of course, and love to have you. We did briefly talk about this book. Then that was before publishing.
Yeah.
It's an amazing book, Francesca. It's
really,
it's,
you really?
Know, it's I think so. It's very entertaining. It's academic and it's very clever. And I'm not claiming I understood all of it, but or followed all of it. I listened to it on the audiobook, which is always a delight. But it's, you know, it's very, you draw the readers in. It's you know, anyone who's interested in biblical criticism or what or who God is should definitely have a read or a listen. What was the genesis? I would have said that anyway, but it's very clever now said to you. Where did this book come from? How did it all begin for you?
I talk a bit about it at the beginning of the book in that, yeah. I'm an atheist. I always have been and definitely always will be. But I was always really curious about religion. I just thought, not because I thought it was balmy, but because I thought, I just didn't understand what motivated people to believe in otherworldly beings. And, you know, there's some religion in my family, like my grandparents and that. But yeah, so I went off to do my degree in theology at Oxford when I was 18 because I was just, and I did a theology degree. And Oxford is like quite a kind of traditional sort of Christian, Western Christian thing. And everyone was religious. And so I was a bit of an outsider. But I just found it really fascinating. And no one was talking. So I started reading these biblical texts properly for the first time when I was at university. And it seemed very obvious to me that this was a God who was like the ancient Greek gods and goddesses, who had a body and a temper and was kind of quite capricious. But no one was talking about that when I was at university. And so in a way, this is the book that I wanted to read when I was at university. And it's, you know, obviously after my degree, I went on and did my master's and my doctorate and specialising in all this kind of stuff. And I now teach it. So a lot of this has come out of the stuff that I do with my own students, my own undergraduates at Exeter. And yeah. I just thought, I'm going to write this stuff down. And so I did. And here it is.
And so it's basically the idea that we now view God, or generally people view God or the Christian God or the Jewish God, as a sort of invisible force, a spirit somewhere up in heaven that doesn't have a body.
Yeah.
But your argument and your research seems to show that certainly in pre-biblical times, and a bit in biblical times, that he was considered to be like basically a slightly big bloke. Would that be a fair way of saying it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing, because, you know, so Judaism and Christianity, as we know them, are very broadly speaking post-biblical religions, in the sense that these religions developed after the texts that we find in what Christians call the Old Testament and Jewish people call Tanakh, after those texts were written and after the New Testament texts were written. So that idea that God is completely disembodied, immaterial, and the idea that the spiritual realm, whatever that is completely immaterial, they're relatively late developments in the career of God. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in like this early history of the deity. And I think we need to take seriously the fact that the biblical texts themselves, most of them are quite comfortable with the idea that God has a body, and it's a male body. It's human shaped. It's kind of got male bits. And I think that's quite important to kind of register that and to like grapple with it, given, you know, the world and patriarchy and all that other stuff. I think it's quite important to kind of recognize that this is a God that has changed massively over thousands of years.
Sure. And I think that's what I mean. I sort of like fancy myself as someone who's a little bit of a biblical scholar, but very early in the book, I was sort of confronted with something that I'd never come across. I guess I've mainly sort of been interested in Jesus and the New Testament, not so much the Old Testament. But there's a revelation quite early on. I don't want to give spoilers, but I'm going to have to. That Jesus, that God, our God, Yahweh, if you want to call him that, if that's his name, has a dad and lots of brothers, and is part of this panoply of gods rather than than one God on his own. So, which presumably comes mainly from older texts than the Bible.
Yeah, I mean, things like a lot of the traditions that we have in the Bible, you know, have an earlier history, and so you get a lot of older mythology that's kind of being filtered through into these different biblical traditions. Like, you know, and that extends into the New Testament text as well. But yeah, this idea that, you know, it was very much, this was a minor deity originally from, you know, quite a small, like, polytheistic context within a pantheon. He sort of gradually rises up through the ranks and takes on the roles and titles of his dad, the high god Ael. And so in that sense, he's very similar to, you know, to exactly the sorts of deities that we find in ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia and Greece and Rome. So I kind of wanted to put him back in his natural habitat and sort of say, you know, where does this idea come from? And even when you get to the point where this is a deity who is being portrayed in more monotheistic terms, so in other words, that he is the only deity, he's still not on his own in the heavenly realms. You know, he's still got kind of these other divine colleagues and peers, and it's, that stuff is rich throughout all the biblical texts, and it's great to see the Bible in that way. You know, people think the Bible's really boring or irrelevant, you know, if they're not believers, and if they are believers, they think it's absolutely God's truth, and I just wanted to show that the Bible's neither of those things. It's actually like far more interesting and fascinating and cool.
And so all the brothers.
Let's call them cousins.
Cousins.
Yeah.
Have they become like the angels? Is that sort of, as the story has progressed, they've become sort of angelic horde of people?
Yeah. Well, some of them have become sort of vilified. So someone like the figure of the Satan. And there's a definite article in front of that name. I mean, Satan in Hebrew basically means something like adversary or tester or accuser, and he's basically God's right-hand man in the book of Job, for example. He's like kind of his justice minister who goes around testing people, sort of policing the earthly realm a bit. But then he gets vilified and sort of relegated later on. But then other deities equally become very vilified, like the god Baal. But then you get, you know, some of his divine messengers. These are kind of like like messengers, you know, that these sort of emissaries that kind of shuttle between the heavens and the earthly realm, they kind of get relegated into these kind of angelic figures. But then they kind of get re-mythologized later. They become Gabriel and Michael, you know, these kind of archangel figures. It's a lot about adoption and adaption and recycling, upcycling and downcycling of divine beings.
I mean, it's fascinating to see how really, I mean, I'm fascinated by that, about how religions all change and adapt and become totally different things. You would sort of think in a way, you would feel the earliest texts must be the most accurate text for, in terms of, if you were going to believe in something, you think, well, I have to go right to the beginning, because obviously those are the least diluted by human thought or whatever. Even though it must all be a little bit, but people don't, you know, religious people don't tend to, I mean, even really read their own the main books, I think, do they? If you read just even the Bible, you'd get a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. So even when you read the Bible, like, people think that, oh, the book of Genesis must be the earliest because it's talking about origins and beginnings of the cosmos, and it's at the very beginning of the Bible. But that's one of the latest books in the Old Testament. So, like, a more sort of mythologically, a lot of that, the older material is found in things like some of the old poems that you get in the Bible and some of the Psalms in the book of Job, even, which is quite a late text, but it's like got very early poetic and mythological ideas in it. So it's primarily comparing that mythology that's kind of threaded through the biblical texts with similar mythologies from close cultures, like, you know, ancient, what we call Canaanite cultures and Mesopotamian cultures, that you actually better understand the broader mythological and cultural landscape. And that's where you need to locate that deity, not in this kind of world that's really shaped by Christianity and Judaism later on, and the way it retrojects its preferred theology, its later theology, back onto the text. You've got to put the text in their original cultural context, and some of these are Iron Age, and we need to see them in that way.
Yeah, so Ael was the original god, and even in the Bible, like the earlier prophets sort of seem to be worshipping Ael, and then I quite enjoyed the bit, I think, where Yahweh comes along and goes, it was me all along. I was pretending.
It's amazing. So, like, when Moses meets Yahweh in the book of Exodus, you know, there's the big scene at the burning bush, and this voice is speaking to Moses out of the flames, and Yahweh says, oh yeah, so you know how your ancestors, Abraham and I, you know how they were worshipping El Shaddai, and Moses, yes, and he says, well, actually, that was me. I mean, my name's Yahweh, really, but actually, you know, I was only known to them by my name, Ael, but actually it's classic sort of spin doctoring. It's sort of trying to identify the god Yahweh with the older kind of god Ael and sort of bringing them together, like trying to say that these are one and the same. When originally they were understood as two distinct deities. And you get reflections of how they're understood as distinct deities.
That's basically why the religions are changing, isn't it, throughout, as we go through, and why this whole change from a bodily to a non-bodily god goes, because you're trying to get more converts, you're trying to meld together two different groups of people who believe two opposing things, and so you have to come up with compromises that make those things work.
Yeah, and also, you know, that's how Yahweh himself sort of changes. I mean, because these biblical texts are written in times of like massive cultural upheaval. I mean, you know, invasion by the Assyrians and kind of subjugation by them, and then sort of destruction by the Babylonians, and then the Persians come along, and then the Greeks, and then, you know. And so it's like all of these kind of massive cultural shifts, and the biblical texts are written primarily by elite urban people. So they're really at the kind of the forefront of these massive political and cultural changes. And so, you know, their whole world is sort of falling apart around them quite often. And what do you do? You know, is this a deity who used to be a warrior god, who used to fight for you, and now all of a sudden, you know, you're taken off into captivity to some foreign land, and you're like, well, what the hell does this mean about our deity? And so it's those sorts of cultural and political shifts that force a shift in theology, and that sort of changes the nature of the deity even more. So kind of by the time you're into the Greek period, when certain philosophical ideas are really starting to take hold about a distinction between the spiritual and the earthly, and the material and the immaterial, that really starts to impact theology as well much later. So all of those things kind of mean that God, yeah, he's sort of like, his body is gradually eradicated over centuries and centuries and centuries,
So, you know, I was reading a few of the reviews of the book, which are mainly very, very good. And weirdly, the Church Times is very behind it. The Times, the correspondent in the Times was upset because they believe that it's clearly all the talk of God's body in the Bible is metaphorical.
Yeah.
So what makes you think that it isn't metaphorical and that it is actual in brief, without saying the whole book?
Primarily because you look at the ways in which the deities were depicted, not just in terms of text, but in terms of icons, in terms of sort of visual culture. And they were very much understood to have human-shaped bodies. And so humans had God-shaped bodies. And so even when you do find, in even much later post-biblical theologies, you know, people have a hard time letting go of the language of the body of God. So, for example, scholars are increasingly agreed, people in my field, that there probably were images of God that were used in worship. And that's why it's banned in one of the Ten Commandments. You know, you don't ban something unless people are doing it. So God was understood, was imaged as having this God-shaped body. But even like later theologies, you know, people can't let go of the idea. We talk about God seeing us or hearing us or talking to us. You know, that's all that body language doesn't come simply out of metaphor. It comes out of, you know, and we have archaeological evidence for the fact that people did conceive of their body, of gods as having human shaped bodies. And Yahweh was no different. I thought that review in the Times was really interesting because I say interesting in a very loose sense, because I clearly, the reviewer, and I know authors often say this, but clearly the reviewer hadn't bothered to read the introduction to the book. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, dudes, just take the time to read the intro, like I say to my students. But it's been great. I mean, like the Church Times review was surprisingly positive. Church Times hasn't always liked me very much in what I do.
Well, you know, but it's also obviously the very start of the Bible, which isn't from the very start, as you've just said, but you know, that God makes man in his image. If he doesn't have an image, then it, you know, there's plenty of clues in there that at least at some point.
Yeah, God, and I mean, that's the thing. And in that passage, when he says he makes man in his image and likeness, those, you know, just a few, two chapters later, the same language is used to talk about the physical likeness between Adam and one of his sons. And the same terms are used in the biblical text to talk about the likeness of cult statues to the gods that they represent. So when God's using that language, I mean, that's exactly what it means. It means a physical likeness, a visual corporeal likeness. And, you know, Jewish rabbis are completely happy with this idea in the 6th century, you know, 4th century, 3rd century BC, like CE. They were totally happy with that idea. So it's more of a hang up of kind of a certain kind of Christian male, I think, is my experience, than it is anybody else.
Yeah, but people, you know, it's obviously when you're a biblical scholar and you're not religious yourself as well, there's an extra level to it. People who have strong beliefs about something don't want those beliefs challenged. It's sort of what religion's about, isn't it? It's sort of the reason why these things have all changed, because they're trying to get a group of people all to believe the same stuff, and questioning it makes it fall apart. So, you know, anyone questioning anything is a problem. But like I say, I just sort of think, like, if you're going back to the going to the original sources, it's harder to argue with those than the later ones, which obviously have been influenced by human thought. But you know, it's crazy to me that people can believe something and then not want to, you know, if you really believe it, there's no problem in people asking questions. And so anything that doesn't let you ask questions is suspicious immediately, isn't it?
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, you think about like the Bible itself, the Christian Bible and the Jewish Bible, like the biblical writers and the earliest compilers of all these texts were really happy with the idea of contradiction and challenge and questioning their beliefs and their faith. Because you've got so many contradictions. Like, look at, you know, got four Gospels, for example, in the New Testament, right? Four different versions of the Jesus story, none of which like exactly match up, plus all the other Gospels that didn't make it into the final collection, which are even more crazy, which you and I talked about when we last saw each other. But these ancient compilers, these ancient religious thinkers, were completely comfortable with the idea of differences of opinion and challenge. So for people today to kind of say, well, that's not, you know, the Bible doesn't say that, and that actually, you know, you need to sit more comfortably. I always tell my students this, sit more comfortably with the idea of contradiction and ambiguity and challenge, because the Bible itself sits comfortably with those ideas as well. Mm-hmm. So we've got this very strange sense of treating the Bible like it's some kind of extraordinary object, you know. But what my book does, I hope I've shown, is that, like, let's look at these texts like we would look at ancient Greek mythologies and legends and traditions. Yeah. You know, why should we treat this God of the Bible and these biblical texts any differently than we would any other kind of ancient literature from this time and place? So yeah, that's what this book does.
And also go back and worship Eol, because he's the original one and he's been knocked off by this usurper. So you're worshipping the wrong God, guys. Go back. Because Eol, so you're saying, you say this in the book, that Israel, is that's sort of the clue that God, the original God was Eol, because Israel is named after Eol.
I mean, that Eol is the theophoric element, the divine name in that. But, and you've got this story in Genesis where Jacob, like the great founder of Israel, one of the great ancestors, he builds an altar to Eol, the God of Israel. You know, it's spelled out very clearly in the Hebrew. So, yeah.
Oh, well, it's all very interesting, and we'll talk a bit more about the book. I mean, I think, again, as a layperson, it's great that you often the way into a subject in this book is another example or a modern example. You talk about walking in God's footsteps in Syria and a hidden Michelangelo sculpture, which is very interesting that got hidden away because there was an imperfection in Jesus' face on the marble right at the end, which must have been annoying for Michelangelo.
I can imagine.
Just at the end as well. You know, there's comparisons with Trump and stuff. So there's lots of things to draw you in. Was that... I think you're a very entertaining writer. I think that often is... some academics don't like someone being funny or being interesting or not being dry. Is that an important part of the writing process for you, to use your own humour and your own experience?
Oh, definitely. Like, because, I mean, as I said, like, this book in some ways comes out of my teaching. It's how I do my lectures at work, you know. It's like, how do you draw students in? Like, most of whom are either going to think this is really boring or difficult. So how do you draw the students in? It's the same way, how do you draw the readers in? And the thing is, this stuff is fun. Do you know what I mean? Like, just because it's about religion doesn't mean we should take it so bloody seriously. And it is the most fascinating subject. So, like, how can it not be fun? But I think, when I was writing, I wanted, you know, this is what I think. This is the way I understand it. And this is the way that I want people to get as excited about this ancient stuff as I am. And so by, you know, using comparisons, like, you know, with Donald Trump's kind of penis problems, and nuclear war problems, but classed as a phallic kind of insecure phallic masculinity. But, you know, things like that, and Michelangelo sculptures, and, you know, the discovery of various other ancient artifacts I talk about, and what we do with dead bodies, like, all of that stuff is important, because it contextualizes, in some ways, the book is just as much about our own bodies and what it is to be human as it is about God's body. And so I think that's what most interests me, is the way in which you can find these parallels and these weird juxtapositions that actually help you to understand ancient cultures and these ancient societies much more clearly.
It definitely works.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And when you're writing something like this, do you have Do you have an audience in mind, or are you trying to broaden out so that it's you can sell as many copies as possible, or are you, you know, because it is a very academic book, and it is, you know, it is, there's good thinking in there, and it's turning around a whole school of thought about the Bible, which it's an incredible revolutionary book, but it is also something I think that people can pick up in an airport if they're going on a long holiday. It's not a short book.
No, God's not a short man. So yeah, but I had two. I think being an academic is really weird because you have to, because you're not, you know, most of the time I write for other academics, and so
yeah,
you're kind of joining a conversation that's been going on in my field for centuries, and you're joining it at a certain level. Whereas writing this, obviously, you can't expect that anybody would know anything about the Bible. So on the one hand, I've got a load of academics sitting on my shoulder when I'm writing, and I'm terrified about what they're going to say, because being an atheist and a woman in my field is really hard anyway. And so it's, you know, and people, there's a lot of intellectual snobbery as well in academia. So a lot of other academics would not deign to lower themselves to write a book for the ordinary educated member of the public. So on one hand, I've got all these academics sitting on my shoulder and I'm writing. And then on the other, I've got my mum and my undergraduates. So I'm thinking that they're the people that I'm writing for. If I can explain it sufficiently so that they get it and they understand, then I know that I'm communicating the ideas well.
Yeah. And these books can break through, obviously, into a mass audience as well. You know, they're even quite academic physics books and history books can break through. So, and I hope that, you know, I really hope this has done and will continue to do. It's also very enjoyable. I'm an audiobook fan. I listen to most of this on audiobook. I also have a copy of the book. You did it yourself as well, which is not so usual. But did you enjoy the process of doing that?
No, it was awful. It was so horrendous. That's when I was thinking, why the hell did I write such a bloody long book?
Yeah.
Because it was. But, and also because it's so hard not to do voices, like not to do the voices when I was reading these biblical texts. And often it's like, you know, Yahweh says this and God says yeah. that. And it's so hard to not kind of slide into whoa when I'm doing Yahweh's voice. And something slightly more effeminate for Jesus. And so, like, I'm going to get in so much trouble. But that was really hard not to do the comedy voices like I yeah. often do in lectures. And, you know, sliding into little bits of Monty Python kind of style voices as well, you know, for like, it's really difficult. But yeah, so doing the audiobook was hard.
Well, it was fun to hear you. There's lots of sort of sweary bits and sexy bits in it. And it's kind of fun to hear you, you know, saying lots of swear words and stuff. You don't get to, you know, people might enjoy the book just for that.
Yeah.
For that part. It's worthwhile for that alone.
A guy once tweeted me years ago asking for photos of my feet. Obviously I did not give him photos of my feet. But I've had a few things like that. And there are certain points in the book when I thought, you know what, I do get some weird kind of fan mail. There are some bits in this book that I expect some people are quite going to enjoy, but not for the reasons that I would want them to.
Well, yeah, I know I did.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
So that's good. The thing with the audiobooks and academic books, I think, is all books a little bit, it's if you lose the chain of thought, that's the great thing about having a book is you can go back and work out who's who. And so with but I think this book, you know, I'm walking my dog and think, you go off and start thinking about something else. But it did work as an audiobook, which I think is a great compliment, because I think when something's this complicated, it's quite hard to to keep your listener engaged and also just in there. So it's worth buying as an audiobook if you're an audiobook fan. How many days did it take to record this audiobook?
Oh, God, it felt like I was in the recording studio. I did it last summer and it felt like I was there like every single day. I think it took 2 weeks.
Right.
Like doing 4 hours a day for 2 weeks.
No, that's long. I would do a little bit longer day, but yeah, I don't know how long that would take me. My books usually take a couple of days to do, but they're nothing compared to this. Although I've just finished my latest book. I've just sent in the not quite final, but hopefully final copy. And I do quote your book in my book.
Did you? Thank you.
It's all about testicles, my book. So. It's talking about the Sumerian stuff, which about Enki.
Oh, Enki masturbating and
yeah. But then also the Yahweh fructifying with the earth of Israel, and having sex. So yeah, so thank you for that. So you are, you know, you've given me an extra academic level to my mainly bawdy book about testicles. But so there, you know, there's lots of fun stuff in this, and obviously I think last time we did talk about God's penis, which obviously comes up.
Yeah.
The coming of the Lord comes up a lot. I was also enjoyed God's bum makes an appearance. I didn't know he would necessarily have a bum.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, look at the Sistine Chapel. Michelangelo paints God's bum. I mean, his bum, right. You know, Michelangelo was pretty good on his biblical texts. Yeah, but God's bum makes an appearance. And, you know, did God defecate or not? And did Jesus defecate or not? And did Moses defecate or not? I mean, people were obsessed for quite a few centuries about whether divine figures actually defecated. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff, and the shit gods, obviously, are in there. So, yeah.
Do you think God defecated? Because that it would be odd to have all the system. If he's got a bum hole, my son's obsessed with bum holes, and he asked me if ghosts have bum holes, but I think equally you could ask if God has a bum hole, because that implies he, you know, eats food and...
And you
think he does, right? You think he eats food and so he would need to get rid of his food.
I suspect so. But, I mean, so on the one hand, God's dad, Ael, we've got this myth about him defecating. I mean, he gets so drunk that he literally shits himself and pisses himself. So you'd imagine that if Ael, his dad, could do that, then theoretically so could Yahweh. But the biblical writers, they're very happy about the idea of the god Baal defecating. But they stop themselves kind of thinking that their own deity could. But then, you know, just because you've got a bum hole, so to speak, doesn't mean to say that you could defecate. So with all the early Christian debates about Jesus and whether he did or not, people would say, some very eminent theologians, Christian thinkers, would argue that, yes, Jesus did eat food properly, but he was miraculously constipated, because they didn't like the idea of Jesus producing what they basically called corrupted matter, so shit, basically. So they said that he could control his body so much that he could eat whatever he wanted, but had no need to defecate.
Well, you know, but it's possible. He could have just defecated something nice. It could have just changed it into flower petals or something.
Yeah, and some people did argue that. They sort of basically said that he defecated kind of almost like a kind of a perfumed unguent. so some people did.
I don't want to like go too much into the detail of all the different bits and pieces, just because I want people to be able to read the book and find that stuff out. But you do talk, basically all the body parts get a mention, right down to genitalia and hands and feet, I think all that stuff about the Holy of Holies in those early temples is very interesting, where there's sort of the idea was that the God actually, whoever's God and whichever God you was yours for your tribe, sort of lived inside that Holy of Holies. So he was actually not just a body, but was a body who was there. So those footprints that we talked about, that was, they're made to look like he's walked in or...
Like the deity striding into the temple. I mean, it is amazing. Yeah. And that is very much the sense. I think there's something that, you know, an atheist that I am, I think there's something that's lost from a lot of modern day religions. It's the sense that somehow these sacred buildings simply represent the place at which you can have some kind of formal communication with your deity. Because back in the day, these places literally were where the deity was held to be. You were literally in the presence of the deity. And I think that's an amazing thing. Like, you get that kind of, it's almost as if, again, I am this cold, stone-hearted atheist, but, you know, going somewhere like Stonehenge or into ancient, you know, very ancient churches or some of these early temples and stuff, you do kind of get a sense that these are more than just ordinary places, that these are somehow otherworldly in some way. And I think it's a real shame that, you know, that people don't make more of that in their own religions. I'd be a lot more interested in being a believer if someone said to me the deity is actually here. I mean, not just in, you know, bread and wine, as in behind this curtain.
Well, I would believe it if I went in and I saw him. So, you know, that's what it would take for me. But and why do you think this, out of all these potential desert gods and all these different areas, what was it? Is it just chance that this one has the one that's dominated, or is there some reason why Yahweh kind of appealed more, or is it just that, you know, some brilliant publicist, or is it because it was basically the temple was destroyed, right? And he was
it was destroyed and then rebuilt. So it's destroyed in the 6th century BCE in Jerusalem, then rebuilt in the 5th century BCE, and then finally destroyed again by the Romans in the 1st century CE. So in some ways it's chance that it was this particular deity that happened to be become the most important, simply because this happened to be the deity who became sort of the patron god of this Judahite community, but, you know, whose central temple was in Jerusalem. But I think because of the relationship, because Christianity emerged out of Judaism, and because of the importance of texts, the idea that somehow texts became authoritative. So once you've got a religion that's writing its stuff down, and the texts themselves become not just authoritative in terms of teaching, but become iconic. They literally become iconic. They replace statues of the god. So the scrolls within, you know, pre-Christianity, the scrolls of Judaism become sort of almost function like a statue of a god would have functioned in the older forms of Yahweh worship. And then gradually, you know, with the emergence of Christianity, texts became really important for kind of spreading that particular inflection of Judaism around. Because obviously, you know, the Jesus movement was a Jewish movement. So texts become important for kind of communicating that around the Mediterranean. And once it's around the Roman Empire and it becomes kind of adopted officially, so they say, as the religion of the Roman Empire, then obviously this god is firmly implanted in the West as the deity.
But do you think way back in, you know, before 2,000, 3,000 years before Christ, if just a different battle had turned out differently, or do you think it could have been a different god, or do you think there was something special, particularly?
I don't think he was particularly special, but I think the fact that he got rid of his pantheon very early on, I think the fact that he got rid of his wife early on, I think the fact that it became a very masculinist, patriarchal kind of, I think that is one of the reasons why people are so keen to hang on to it, because men.
Yeah, it's down to men and power. Good, that's good to know. Well done to us. I suppose the Holy Trinity thing, which is also discussed, the Father, the Son, and the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost, which I'd never really understood, but that again is another attempt to bring together just these different ideas and smash them together so he can be corporeal and not corporeal, and alive and not alive, and here and not here. That
exactly. So, like, I think there's lots of things going on with the idea of the Trinity. I mean, it's not in the Bible itself. It's not the New Testament. The only thing that's in the New Testament is Jesus saying, in the Gospels, he instructs his disciples to go out and baptize in the name of the Father and the Son and the Spirit. So that's what the earliest Jesus followers were doing. They were baptizing new members into their guild, like by means of this three-part formula. So by the time, like, you know, so people think, well, are these three different deities, or are these, you know, what's going on? So by the time you get the early kind of church fathers agonizing about this and trying to insist that they are still monotheistic, even though they blatantly look polytheistic, so they kind of come up with the notion of, you know, they sort of try to describe how the Trinity is in fact one in three and three in one. Yeah. And you're quite right, it is illogical. Theological philosophy is illogical. But on the other hand, you've also got this sense in which, like, Christianity is also keen, you know, if Jesus hadn't been properly human, then he couldn't have properly died, which means that he couldn't have properly, you know, resurrected. So the insistence that Jesus had to be fully human and fully God was so important that it rendered everything about a divine body, about the bodiliness of the divine, it rendered it almost like it had to be exclusive to Christianity alone. Otherwise, this miraculous event of God becoming flesh incarnate, dying, and then rising up again is meaningless. It's nothing. And so I think it's that particular emphasis on the idea that Christians had to have the exclusive claim on kind of divine corporeality, like it was their God. And I think that's one of the reasons why they, philosophically and culturally speaking, they were so keen to dismiss the idea that God had ever had a body before that.
Yeah.
But obviously, the texts say something different.
Yeah, well, it's absolutely fascinating. I do encourage everyone to buy this book and have a read. It's very interesting stuff. Is this something like just in terms, because I usually ask about how you get something published and stuff, but obviously like an academic book or a book from an academic is sort of slightly different. Maybe it's kind of hard to just write an academic book and send it in. Was this something you, how long were you working on it and how easy was it to find a publisher for it, or was it the other way around?
It's weird because, yeah, I've written a lot of academic monographs and books and stuff like that, and they're kind of relatively easy to get published because you don't get paid for them. Which is amazing. So like academic press is like, yeah, fine. But this book was different. I was approached by my now agent, my literary agent, who had he had seen me on various TV things and had written to me saying, I think you should write a book for the ordinary reader. And I was like, don't be ridiculous, I can't do that. I'm an academic. Like, well, I can't write in a way that's interesting and intelligent and kind of entertaining. But then I thought, actually, maybe I could do that. And so, yeah, like it was a very different process, like getting it published. It was great. I mean, that we had, it went into one of those competitive publishers bidding high amounts of money to have it, which was amazing. But writing it is the hardest thing I've ever written in my life. Like, as I said, I've written loads of academic books and fine, I can do those until the cows come home. But this was so hard because I was trying to communicate really complex scholarly ideas and research and debates, trying to communicate that in a way that's not boring and is not off-putting and isn't dumbing down either. Yeah. That is so hard. So it took me longer to write than I thought it would. Like I started writing in year one and realised I hadn't actually written anything at all. Like literally hadn't written anything. I'd sort of done a lot of sunbathing that year and thinking about how am I going to write this? But then, yeah, like, so it took about 4 years and obviously COVID didn't help. Just in terms of getting a lot of the stuff that I needed for research, that was really hard. But yeah, but it was the hardest thing. It's the hardest thing I've ever written, but I loved it. I loved it.
Yeah. And have you got another book? Are there more lined up? Have you got another idea?
Yeah, there's another one coming, but I haven't quite decided enough about it yet to talk about it. But yeah, there's another one coming.
Great. Well, look, thanks so much for giving us so much of your time and talking about your fantastic book, God and Anatomy, Francesca Stavrakopoulou. You've got to change your name so it's more
easy to Google. I know. I got married a few months ago and and my husband said, thank you. And my husband said, are you going to change your name? I said, of course I'm not going to change my name. and I said, would you like to take my name instead? And he said, don't be ridiculous. You know, your name is yeah, so the name stays, but and I know it terrifies everybody, but you're super good at it.
I know, I love it. Oh, I do love it, really. the Francesca's hard. You've got to change to Francesca. Change that to something easier to say, and that will be very good. Look, thank you very much, Francesca, for doing this. Thank you to Chris Evans, not that one, for all his help on this. And happy birthday! It's his birthday today, Francesca, and he's sitting there listening to this.
I know, happy birthday.
He'll be all confused by
what have you done?
He won't understand what's going on.
Do go and buy Francesca's book. We'll be back next week. I don't know who's the next book club's going to be. So that's a very exciting thing to find out. Thank you very much. See you next time. Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. richardherring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And gofasterstripe.com. You can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who said hello so far. Do come and say hello after the show if you enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.